states in the Republican column, and bring about a dedicated Protestant vote to counteract the Catholic vote. Aware that this kind of specific political advice ran directly counter to his professions of nonpartisanship, Graham added, "I would appreciate your considering this letter in utter confidence. You do me a favor by destroying it after reading it." Kennedy allegedly sought to short-circuit anti-Catholic bias by asking Graham and other prominent clergymen to sign a pledge not to bring religion into the campaign. Graham refused to sign, and in announcing that refusal, Grady Wilson tossed in the unlikely and never verified allegation that Roman Catholics in Latin America had recently conducted a special mass during which they had prayed that the plane bringing Billy Graham to Brazil that summer would crash and kill the evangelist. Wilson's statement, made on a local radio station, drew sharp objection from Kennedy's press secretary, Pierre Salinger, who denied any effort to get anyone to sign a pledge. But Grady stuck by what he had said. Graham, however, wrote to Lyndon Johnson, asking him to assure Senator Kennedy that he did not intend to raise the religious issue publicly and hoped to stay out of the political campaign as much as possible. A week later, Johnson sent a note thanking Graham and noting that Kennedy had been obviously impressed by your attitude. In midsummer, both parties chose their candidates. Ignoring Graham's advice, Nixon opted for Henry Cabot Lodge. In a cannier but ambivalent move, Kennedy sought to appeal to the South and Southwest by selecting Lyndon Johnson. Graham's expressed intention to stay out of the campaign was short-lived. 2 weeks after his letter to Johnson, he returned from a meeting of the Baptist World Alliance in Rio de Janeiro, filled with fresh concern that Nixon was floundering. "This conference of religious leaders all agree," he wrote, "that your people are not nearly so well organized as the Kennedy people. I heard this from man after man representing different parts of the nation." He noted that Kennedy was getting his name in the papers more often than Nixon, and that despite a recent Gallup poll showing that Nixon's chances were improving, he felt Kennedy was still ahead. He then added presciently, "Your debates with him on television will be decisive in the minds of millions." Graham predicted trouble on both the racial and religious fronts. He had traveled to and from the Baptist Conference with Martin Luther King, Jr., and learned that King had met with Kennedy at Joseph Kennedy's apartment in New York and had been tremendously impressed by the senator. In other accounts of the meeting, King was said to have found Kennedy pleasant, but lacking a depth understanding of the racial situation. But Graham felt the black leader was just about sold on the senator. "I think I at least neutralized him," he noted, "but ventured that if you could invite him for a brief conference, it might swing him. He would be a powerful influence." Dr. King, like Dr. Graham, was determined not to endorse either party's candidates, asserting that his cause transcended partisan politics. But Graham's perception that Kennedy was capable of loosening the Republican grip on the black vote was accurate. Nixon decided against contact with King, probably feeling blacks would not desert the party of Lincoln. 60% of the black vote in 1956 went to Eisenhower. And that association with the controversial leader would alienate white voters, particularly in the South. Ultimately, however, after both John and Robert Kennedy made telephone calls that offered encouragement to Coretta King and helped free her husband from a Georgia prison a few days before the election, facts disseminated to black churches on the Sunday before the election, Kennedy garnered a stunning 70% of the black vote, even though King maintained to the end his refusal to give an explicit endorsement. Graham must have been surprised at what appeared to be a tactical mistake on Nixon's part, since his close scrutiny of the campaign had led him to believe that God has been giving you supernatural wisdom in handling difficult situations. On the other hand, he and Norman Vincent Peale had been commissioned by a gathering of ministers to urge the vice president to say more about religion in his addresses, and he told Nixon, "These men reported that throughout Protestantism, there is a running question as to your religious convictions. They report that many people are concerned at this point. I informed them of your reticence to use religion for political purposes. They felt people had a right to know. Therefore, I would urge you to weave this into your addresses." He noted that Peel would soon be coming out flat-footed in favor of Nixon, a move he estimated might prove extremely costly to the popular minister. Overall, Graham was optimistic. He thought the proportion of Protestant clergy now supporting Nixon, an estimated 76%, would probably increase, and expressed satisfaction that the Catholic bloc vote would not be quite as solid as he once supposed. He also reported that he had written to his mailing list, which included 2 million American families, urging them to organize their Sunday school classes to get out the vote. He suspected the majority of these people were registered as Democrats or Independents, but because of his well-known friendship with the Vice President, he felt a concerted effort to stimulate the vote might produce a significant swing in Nixon's direction, and was encouraging other religious organizations likely to be favorable to Nixon to follow his lead. He urged Nixon not to give up on Southern and border states, in spite of lingering Southern animosity toward Eisenhower for forcing compliance with federal court desegregation orders. Graham felt the more conservative platform of the Republican Party, combined with a religious issue, could well put some of the states in your column. Graham also had some tactical advice for Eisenhower. In a confidential letter sent after the convention, he urged the president to stump the southern states on Nixon's behalf. "With a religious issue growing," he observed, "I believe you could tip the scales in a number of key states, from Kentucky to Texas. I believe Nixon has a fighting chance only if you go all out." In a characteristic flight of hyperbole, he said, "I know this would mean 2 months of hard work, but I believe the rewards to the nation would be as great as when you led the armies at Normandy." He further suggested that the president, whom he once again compared to Lincoln, not limit his efforts to the hustings. "It is also my opinion," he volunteered, "that you must win the battle in the coming special session of Congress. It seems to me that you could send so many dramatic messages to Congress that you could keep Kennedy and Johnson off balance and capture the headlines during that period." Perhaps unfortunately for Nixon's campaign, Graham was holding crusades in Europe during most of August and September, but he assured the vice president that the election would not be far from his thoughts. "He would be on the transatlantic phone constantly," he said, "and would be delighted to be of any service I possibly can." In a remarkable change from the days in which he begged for the approval of his ministry by politicians, Graham suggested that Nixon's cause might be helped by a trip to Montreat as soon as possible after the European tour ended. "Such a visit," he wrote, "would certainly be a dramatic and publicized event that I believe might tip the scales in North Carolina and dramatize the religious issue throughout the nation, without mentioning it publicly. This is just a suggestion, and we would be delighted to cooperate in it if you think it has any merit." The highlight of Graham's 2-month European tour was a 7-day crusade in West Berlin, in what the East Berlin government unsurprisingly regarded as a direct affront. The crusade's closing rally was held in a huge tent set up in front of the old Reichstag building, just 300 yards from the Brandenburg Gate. The Berlin Wall would not be erected for another year, but the communist government dispatched 150 police officers to the Brandenburg Gate and sent scores of others to patrol other crossing points in an effort to discourage East Germans from attending the services. However much they might deride the content of his messages, they respected his ability to draw huge crowds, and they knew that his ever-present anti-communist rhetoric could only be detrimental to their efforts to maintain ideological uniformity. An East German daily charged that whenever the American imperialists begin their provocative act, wherever the policy of the Washington and Bonn warmongers is shaky, Billy Graham and his staff officers are sent. East Berlin Mayor Waldemar Schmidt warned that if the tent remained in place, West Berlin would suffer the consequences, without specifying just what that might entail. West Berlin Mayor Willy Brandt curtly indicated he had no intention of calling for the tent to be moved. But Graham minimized tensions by refraining from any mention of politics in his sermon to the 25,000 people, many of whom were East Germans who had made it through the police blockade. Though he remained quiet on the Eastern Front, Graham made good on his promise to stay abreast of the election campaign at home. Most of his colleagues in the new evangelical camp would probably vote for Nixon, no matter whom the Democrats put forward. But Kennedy's religion led them to view the 1960 election as particularly portentous. In a sermon preached at Park Street in June and subsequently published, Harold John Akinge articulated concerns he felt all Protestant Christians ought to share. While acknowledging that a Catholic had every right to run for the presidency, he observed that a keystone of American democracy is the separation of church and state, and that the Roman Catholic Church had not been a notable champion of that particular principle. He noted that a prominent candidate in this coming election had insisted that whatever his religion was in private, it could not take precedence over his oath as President of the United States. But he pointed out that several Roman Catholic publications had sharply criticized the unnamed candidate for such statements. A strong individual might ignore such criticism, Akinge admitted. But the pressures would always be there for him to succumb, especially when there is the possibility of excommunication for disobedience, and such excommunication could mean the loss of his soul. If the American Catholic hierarchy were to acknowledge that America is a pluralistic society and bring pressure on the Vatican to renounce policies aimed at exerting control over the temporal realm, then Americans might have little to fear from a Catholic president. But unless and until that happened, Protestants would do well not to aid and abet the movement toward Roman Catholic domination of America by electing a president who has more power to advance such a goal than any other person. In a speech entitled Protestant Distinctives and the American Crisis, and reprinted as a tract, Graham's father-in-law painted a similar picture. Catholics observed American rules and conventions regarding religious freedom, Dr. Bell contended, only because they had to. He characterized the Roman Catholic Church as a political system that, like an octopus, covers the entire world and threatens those basic freedoms and those constitutional rights for which our forefathers died in generations past, and warned that once a nation becomes 51% Catholic, the pressure increases, and as the percentage rises in favor of that church, tolerance recedes and oppression intervenes. He pointed to suppression of Protestant beliefs and practice in Italy and in various Latin American countries, adding ominously, Rome never changes. Akinge and Bell were hardly voices crying in a wilderness. In the fundamentalist camp, John R. Rice, Bob Jones Sr., and Carl McIntyre predictably sounded even more strident notes, and the executive director of the National Association of Evangelicals wrote a moderate but clearly pessimistic booklet entitled, A Roman Catholic President? How Free from Church Control? The NAE also sent a plan of action letter to evangelical pastors, suggesting they emphasize the dangers of Roman Catholicism as well as the evergreen threats of communist infiltration and general spiritual and moral decay. Public opinion is changing, the letter warned, in favor of the Church of Rome. It is time for us to stand up and be counted as Protestants. We dare not sit idly by, voiceless and voteless, and lose the heritage for which others have died. Christianity today conjured similar visions of dark days ahead if a Catholic occupied the White House, and a BGEA flyer advertising the inaugural issue of Decision magazine reminded evangelicals of their responsibility to participate in government. We Christians, it asserted, must work and pray as never before in this election, or the future course of America could be dangerously altered, and the free preaching of the gospel could be endangered. On the campus of evangelical colleges, students expressing a preference for Kennedy were open to accusations of spiritual laxity. At Wheaton College, prejudice made the short leap to overt discrimination, as students favoring Nixon were permitted free use of the college service to tout their candidate, while the few Kennedy backers were charged regular rates to mail their literature. Not all such forebodings came from evangelicals and fundamentalists. A group of Protestant clergymen led by Norman Vincent Peale and calling themselves the National Conference of Citizens for Religious Freedom asserted that Kennedy could not withstand the Roman hierarchy's determined efforts to breach the wall of separation of church and state. G. Bromley Oxnam, chairman of the Methodist Church's Council of Bishops and president of both the Federal and World Council of Churches, and Presbyterian Eugene Carson Blake, president of the National Council, both acknowledged they were uneasy that a Roman Catholic president could strengthen Catholic influence in government and society, and felt it might be difficult for him to square his political duties with obligations to his church when it came to such matters as parochial schools, birth control, and the separation of church and state. They did, however, profess an admiration for Kennedy and said they would consider voting for him. If pressed on the matter, Billy Graham could contend that he was not personally responsible for any of these statements, even those produced by his own organization, but he shared at least some of these apprehensions. In his letter urging Eisenhower to take a more active role in supporting Nixon, he expressed concern that if Lyndon Johnson were to become vice president, Roman Catholic Mike Mansfield would be in line to become Senate Majority Leader. With Massachusetts Congressman John McCormick as floor leader in the House, Catholics would hold two extremely powerful positions. The Roman Catholic Church, Graham warned, will take advantage of this. A few days later, reporters quoted him as saying that a man's religion cannot be separated from his person. Therefore, where religion involves political decision, it becomes a legitimate issue. When asked if the religious issue would be important in this election, he replied, "Yes, I have been informed by political experts that it will be deeper than in 1928, when Roman Catholic Al Smith ran against Herbert Hoover, because people are better informed." He added that some Protestants are hesitant about voting for a Catholic, because the Catholic Church is not only a religious, but a secular institution, which sends and receives ambassadors from secular states. Seeing his own words in print, however, caused second thoughts, and he quickly sent statements to both Time and Newsweek, denying he had John Kennedy in mind when he made these observations about religion and politics. Despite this waffling, Graham's interest in the religious issue stemmed less from fear of Kennedy's Catholicism than from awareness that raising the specter of religious bigotry could help Kennedy's campaign. He also recognized that some objections to Kennedy were just what they were portrayed to be, bigotry, and that troubled him. He told Nixon early in September that he was detaching myself from some of the cheap religious bigotry and diabolical whisperings that are going on. I'm not so much opposed to Kennedy as I am for you. He also strongly urged Nixon not to participate in any such attacks. At all costs, he urged, you must continue to stay a million miles from the religious issue at this time. As Graham feared, Kennedy adroitly turned his Catholicism to his own advantage. In a bold move, his religious advisor, James Wine, a Presbyterian elder and former official of the National Council of Churches, arranged a September meeting with a large group of ministers in Houston, a hotbed of anti-Catholic sentiments. A master at handling hostile questions in extempore fashion, Kennedy faced his antagonists head-on and gave them unambiguous, reassuring answers about his relative allegiance to the Constitution and the Roman magisterium. Repeatedly and without hesitation, he made it clear that if in his role as president he faced a conflict between his obligation to America and his obligation to the Vatican, either he would give precedence to his obligation to America or he would vacate his office. The Houston meeting was a pivotal event in the campaign, and Graham knew it. He told Nixon that Kennedy's tactic seemed to be working, and that a high-ranking Democratic leader had told him Kennedy might be elected solely on the religious issue. Graham recommended that Nixon put his enemies on the defensive by having Eisenhower, Senator Jacob Javits, and Thomas Dewey point out that the Democrats had led both Protestants and Catholics into a political trap by highlighting religious prejudice. In view of a fusillade of criticism, the press and some liberal religious leaders had launched against Norman Vincent Peale, after he both endorsed Nixon and questioned whether Kennedy could govern free of Vatican control, Graham felt it imperative that he not make any public statement on the religious issue. Not only would the press and liberal religious leaders crucify me, he explained, but they would eventually turn it against you. So I must be extremely careful. I've been avoiding the American press the last few weeks like the plague, but when I arrive home next week, I will make statements that will by implication be interpreted as favorable to you without getting directly involved. As the campaign moves on, I may be forced to take a more open stand if I feel it will help your cause, but we shall wait for the developments. Graham's public reticence masked intense private concern over the election. With the exception of a three-day crusade aimed at Hispanics in New York City, his fall schedule was light, and he spent at least part of his free time concocting political strategy. In an October 17 letter marked confidential and urgent, he offered several concrete suggestions for Nixon's consideration. First, he counseled the vice president should take a strong position, critical of Cuba's turn toward communism, an issue on which Kennedy was scoring the administration. In what seems an astonishing willingness to manipulate foreign policy for partisan political advantage, Graham recommended that Nixon urge the president to take some dramatic action, perhaps even to break diplomatic relations with Cuba. His other recommendations involved rhetoric more than policy, but reflected relish at being part of the competition. When Kennedy talked of the loss of Cuba and the Congo to communism, he counseled that Nixon should mention the countries that went communist under Democratic administrations. I believe there are at least 20 countries. This would be tremendously impressive and would shut the mouth of your opponent on this point. Candidates and officeholders get an abundance of unsolicited advice, but Nixon and his staff apparently took Graham's counsel seriously. In a memo regarding Graham's suggestion that he take a harder line on Cuba, Nixon told his aides, "I think this makes a hell of a lot of sense. Please note the paragraph where he is talking about the Cuban situation. I would like you, Len Hall, to go over and have a chat with the president about that situation. I don't know whether anything can be done about it, but it does show what the reactions are." Graham continued to be vexed that Kennedy had turned his Catholicism and perception of religious prejudice to political advantage. To offset this, he felt Nixon simply had to persuade some leading Republican to show that Democrats were deliberately using the religious issue to, one, solidify the Catholic vote, two, split the Protestants, three, make a martyr out of Kennedy, and four, obscure the more basic issues in the campaign. Graham regarded this plan as a deliberate and cynical strategy. Protestants and Catholics alike have been caught in a deliberate political trap set for them. Graham urged Nixon to speak out on the need for spiritual revitalization and greater dependence on God and prayer. I wonder if you couldn't say in your next debate that whoever is elected, he's going to have to depend upon God for wisdom, striking a note of humility, and saying frankly that you don't have all the answers, but that whoever is elected should look to God for strength, guidance, and leadership, as Washington and Lincoln did. Many of my advisors believe that a few statements along that line would convince tens of thousands of the uncommitted. He also recommended that you must somehow show that if Kennedy wins, this is going to be a personal repudiation of Eisenhower. A Kennedy victory will be one of the greatest propaganda weapons that Khrushchev ever had. In closing, Graham revealed his belief that the same combination of prayer and pragmatic technique used in his crusades was appropriate to the political realm as well. "You will be interested to know," he said, "that thousands of prayer meetings have been organized across America to pray about this election. I'm certain that during the next few days you're going to sense supernatural wisdom in answer to prayer. I have a sneaking suspicion that by midnight on November 8, we are all going to be rejoicing. In the meantime, a great deal of hard work and praying needs to be done." Billy was ready to do some of that work himself. As his concerns mounted, he sought Henry Luce's advice. Luce suggested that the evangelist write an article for Life, setting forth his own candid evaluation of Nixon. Graham had doubts about such an assignment, but agreed to do it, in part, he admitted, because he felt under such obligation to him for all of his references in Luce publications. He wrote that the vice president did not have the slightest inkling that I am writing this article and probably would have advised against it, but asserted that he had a right and responsibility to speak out just as Reinhold Niebuhr and Union Theological Seminary President and Professor John Bennett had spoken out on behalf of John Kennedy. Noting that this election was the most crucial our nation has ever confronted because Americans were in effect choosing the president of the world, he observed that it would be inappropriate to choose a candidate simply because he was more handsome or charming or to follow the dubious path of tradition and say, "I'll vote for my party, right or wrong." Moreover, he had more faith in the American people than to believe a presidential election could actually be bought by a candidate who happened to be richer, better organized, and more ruthless. If pressed, Graham could claim that these were neutral observations that could apply to any election. But since none of the descriptions other than ruthlessness could possibly fit Nixon, all but the densest readers would construe them as a barely concealed attack on Kennedy. Turning to an explicit consideration of his own favorite, Graham acknowledged that some regarded Nixon as cold, calculating, politically expedient, and intellectually lightweight, but volunteered that I have found him totally different. Richard Nixon, to me, is the epitome of warmth, affability, and sincerity. He has qualities that are found in few people. He has sincere concern for the underprivileged people of the world. In fact, he ventured, Nixon's outstanding quality was sincerity. His mind doesn't seem to reach for political gimmicks. He inspires confidence and commands respect. He has no characteristics of a demagogue. He has a deep personal faith in God, although he doesn't flaunt his faith publicly. I know him to be a deeply religious man. Luce liked the article and scheduled it to run the week before the election. Graham then got cold feet and called several politically astute friends to let them know what he had done. Republican Senator Frank Carlson expressed reservations, but basically approved. U.S. News and World Report publisher David Lawrence and radio commentator Paul Harvey absolutely opposed it, even though both supported Nixon. Graham also tried to reach Nixon during that period, but for never explained reasons, the vice president's staff did not put him through and, according to Graham, seemed terribly indecisive about the proposed article. They were not sure whether it would hurt or help Nixon. This indecisiveness was a contributing factor to my own dilemma. Ruth Graham also felt it was a mistake that would jeopardize Graham's own ministry and destroy any possible chance Nixon had of appealing to Roman Catholics. The anxious couple prayed that if Luce did run the article, God would use it for good, but that if it happened not to meet with divine approval, the Almighty might deploy some small miracle to keep it from appearing. News traveled fast, and the next morning Senator George Smathers, North Carolina Governor Luther Hodges, and Frank Clement all called to express concern. Later in the morning, Henry Luce called to say that he had informed Kennedy of the article, and the senator had strongly urged that Reinhold Niebuhr be asked to write a balancing article. To give him time to consider that request, Luce had pulled the article temporarily, but planned to run it the following week. Taking this as the divine portent he had been seeking, Graham told Luce of his misgivings and asked him not to run the article. In its place, he submitted a nonpartisan article on why Christians should vote, and Luce agreed to run it. After that, Graham said, "I had peace, for I found the Lord had intervened in some strange and mysterious way. I may never know why until I stand before him at the judgment." After Luce let him off the hook, Graham was quoted as saying he was not going to give a straight endorsement of Nixon. "I have come to the conclusion," he said, "that my main responsibility is in the spiritual realm and that I shouldn't become involved in partisan politics." But 2 days later, he was back in the fray, albeit behind the scenes. With less than a week before the election, as it became clear that Kennedy stood a good chance of winning. Graham's advice to Nixon assumed a desperate tone. "There is a great deal of evidence," he alleged, "to indicate that the Democrats have deliberately printed hate material and spread it in Catholic areas to incite the Catholics against you." To counter that effort, he suggested that some leading Republican, probably Eisenhower or Rockefeller, should film a rebuttal, and the campaign should buy as much time as possible in the key electoral states and show the film over and over until the election. Forget money, he urged. You should purchase screen time at any cost. Temporal tactics alone, however, would not suffice, noting that he had received numerous letters from supporters reporting dismay over Nixon's failure to emphasize spiritual matters. Graham counseled the vice president to emphasize his own convictions about the importance of spiritual guidance. State frankly, Graham proposed, that you're a firm believer, putting the election in God's hands and saying, "Thy will be done." He then recommended a course that had worked well for him. Indicate also that you have little personal ambition in this matter, but that you have represented a cause in which you sincerely believe. He noted that voters were not the only pertinent observers. God may be searching your heart, he cautioned, to see where you stand before him. I am convinced that without his help you cannot win this election. To enhance the likelihood that the much-needed divine assistance would be forthcoming, Graham flew to South Carolina the next day to give the invocation at a Nixon rally and to be photographed at the candidate's side as they stood under a banner that defiantly challenged complacent Democrats to recognize that Dixie is no longer in the bag. With or without God's help, Nixon lost one of the closest elections in American history. When the last returns finally trickled in on the morning after the election and it became clear that John Kennedy would be the next president, Graham sent Nixon a consoling telegram. Believe your great campaign has won moral victory. Am certain God will use you greatly in the future. Even so, he gave up grudgingly. 10 days after the election, he said, I understand there is to be a recount of votes in Illinois. Nixon may win there, and they may recount the votes in New Mexico. Those Mississippi electors could still be important. Technically, you know, the president isn't chosen until December 19th. Despite such grasping at straws, Graham must have felt in his heart of hearts that his days of first-name intimacy with the White House were over, at least until 1964, when Nixon might try again. Still, he prudently refrained from any action or statements that would alienate Kennedy, and the president-elect responded in kind. Kennedy would never extend to Graham the right hand of fellowship both Eisenhower and Nixon had proffered, but he understood that it would serve no purpose to harden Graham's resistance to him. Within 2 weeks, Florida Democratic Senator George Smathers, whose campaign manager was an old friend of Graham's, arranged for Graham to have lunch with Kennedy at Key Biscayne. Though pleased to be sought out, Graham hesitated, lest he seem to be fickle or unduly opportunistic. When he ultimately accepted the invitation, he called Nixon's offices to let the vice president know that the meeting in no way detracted from his wholehearted support. The luncheon took place in January, a few days before the inauguration. Both men got what they sought. Graham kept open at least a narrow channel to the White House and had the satisfaction of feeling he might ultimately exert some spiritual influence over the new president. He has often recalled how the dashing young politician suddenly pulled the white Lincoln convertible to the side of the road on the way back from their golf game at Palm Beach, and looking directly at Graham blurted out, "Billy, do you believe that Jesus Christ is going to come back again?" Without hesitation, Graham answered, "I do." Kennedy pondered the matter a moment, then said, "My church teaches it in its creeds, but I don't hear much about it." He also inquired, Graham recalled, about the triumph of the kingdom of God and numerous other topics. He must have asked 100 separate questions, but that exchange appears to have been the extent of theological discussion between the two men. Still, it gave Graham 2 things every preacher needs, hope of success and a good sermon illustration. In return, Graham gave Kennedy an even greater gift. At a press conference that evening, without prior warning to his guest, Kennedy said that Dr. Billy Graham was present and would answer questions about the religious issue that had drawn so much attention during the campaign. Graham recalled that I was scared to death, but I stood up and tried to walk the middle line as much as I could. Few men have proved more adroit at walking the middle line, and Billy's balance and agility did not fail him on this occasion. A New York Times article titled, "Dr. Graham Hails Kennedy Victory," reported that the Reverend Dr. Billy Graham declared tonight that the election of John F. Kennedy, a Roman Catholic, had promoted a better understanding between the Protestant and Catholic churches in the United States. Dr. Graham, the evangelist, said Mr. Kennedy's victory had proved there was not as much religious prejudice as many had feared, and probably had reduced forever the importance of the religious issue in American elections. The article went on to note that Dr. Graham commended Mr. Nixon and his running mate, Henry Cabot Lodge, for not bringing up the religious issue. He also praised Mr. Kennedy for facing the issue forthrightly, thereby easing many fears held by some voters about a Catholic in the White House. Graham said he would not be able to attend the inauguration, though his crusade schedule would have permitted it, but he would watch and pray for the new president. Kennedy's embrace was similarly restrained. Press Secretary Pierre Salinger approved sending Graham photographs of the two men taken at the press conference, but directed aides to make it clear in writing that these pictures are for Mr. Graham's personal use and not for reproduction in his magazines or other publications. Richard Nixon accepted Graham's decision in the Life episode with rueful grace, calling the unused article probably the best and most effective statement in my behalf in the entire campaign, but allowing that the decision not to use it had been proper. Still, he was pleased Billy had felt able to say such kind things about him. "I have deeply appreciated the spiritual inspiration and guidance that you have given me," he wrote shortly before leaving the Capitol for California. "But in addition to that, your political advice has been as wise as any I have received from any man I know. I have often told friends that when you went into the ministry, politics lost one of its potentially greatest practitioners." An interesting glimpse at the fruitful technique of pretending to greater intimacy than may actually exist, Nixon added a postscript. "Pat joins me in sending our very best wishes to Ruth and to you." The draft of the letter contained a parenthetical note: "Check for sure that his wife's name is Ruth." Nixon may have forgiven, but he had not forgotten. A few months later, ostensibly as part of his research for the book Six Crises, he asked Graham to provide an account of the factors that led to his decision not to publish the article for Life. Graham recounted his version, stressing that he had been wholeheartedly for Nixon and had harbored numerous reservations about Kennedy, but that he had not wanted to solidify the Catholic vote or be branded a bigot. Then in a gentle dig at Nixon, he said, "The more I listened to Mr. Kennedy, the less fear I had that all would be lost if he were elected." In fact, he began to say some of the things that I had hoped you would say, mentioning specifically Kennedy's call for sacrifice and dedication on the part of Americans. When Nixon did not respond immediately, Graham grew anxious and wrote another letter to see if his remarks had somehow offended his friend. After an additional period of awkward silence, Nixon again let Billy off the hook, but he could not entirely conceal his disappointment. "In retrospect," he said, "the Life article should have been published and would have been a definite plus." Graham and Nixon remained in occasional contact. After the former vice president's infamous "You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore" press conference, following his unsuccessful bid for the California governorship in 1962, Graham sent a warm pastoral letter urging his friend not to become bitter or to withdraw into a shell and exclude those who care for him. "A man's true character," he said, "is seen in the midst of disappointment and defeat. The petulant behavior at the press conference had given the impression that you were a poor loser and bitter." To correct that impression, he recommended that Nixon hold a combination press conference and party for reporters at which he should apologize for his behavior at the previous gathering. A show of humility, Graham suggested, would silence his critics and bring a wave of sympathy. "You would turn the entire feeling and comment to a tremendous advantage." The concerned pastor apparently also thought his counselee needed some internal rehabilitation. "It would be the greatest tragedy I can think of," he said, "for you to turn to drink or any of these other escapisms. Millions of Americans admire you as no other man of our time." Rather than let disappointment drag him down, Graham urged Nixon to start reading the Bible, learning the value, power, and secrets of prayer, and attending church with new faithfulness. He closed on a note that helped explain the uncommon loyalty he demonstrated to Nixon in later years. "Dick, I have thousands of friends, but very few close, intimate friends. There are few men whom I have loved as I love you. My friendship for you was never because you were vice president or an international figure. It was far deeper than that. And I hope we can continue our friendship on a warmer basis than ever before." Chapter 18. The Kennedy Years. His main bridge to the White House temporarily washed out, his fight with fundamentalism all but over, and his position on integration, no longer requiring daily defense. Billy Graham spent most of the Kennedy years doing what he did best, holding crusades and broadening his base of support. A decade of marathon campaigns had taken such a toll on his physical stamina that he occasionally told reporters he doubted he would live much longer. To give both body and spirit a rest, he began to trim the length of his crusades, moving gradually toward the eight-day, usually Sunday-to-Sunday format, used in most of his meetings since the mid-1960s. He spent the first 4 months of 1961 in Florida, holding a three-week crusade in Miami and a series of 1- and 2-day meetings in a dozen other cities. He also spent a fair amount of time on the beach and the golf course, basking in the warm sunshine he had come to love during his days at the Bible Institute. He followed the Florida campaign with a less-than-brilliant three-week crusade in Manchester, England, and wound up the season with good outings in Minneapolis and Philadelphia. In 1962, Graham added another continent to his list by making 2-month-long forays into South America. Shortly before the first of these, he met with President Kennedy, who was also about to visit South America. In a conversation, Graham recounted with obvious pleasure, the president told the preacher, "I'll be your John the Baptist," graciously implying that he would prepare the way for one who would follow with a greater message. According to Graham's aides, Kennedy felt Graham's visit to South America would strengthen goodwill between the United States and its neighbors unless he became the target of anti-Protestant hostility. He apparently asked what kind of treatment Graham expected from Catholics, an indication he recognized that his co-religionists could be highly resistant to Protestant incursions on what they regarded as their rightful turf, particularly when the intruders were Americans. These apprehensions were not unfounded. In Colombia, the mayor of Barranquilla, apparently acting under pressure from Catholic clergy, denied Graham permission to speak at that city's largest baseball stadium, forcing a move to the grounds of an American Presbyterian school. In Maracaibo, protesters tore down crusade placards, replacing them with leaflets warning citizens not to attend the meetings. And while Graham spoke at a government building, they pounded on the doors, fired guns into the air, and brandished signs that read, "Yankee no, down with Kennedy, and Castro see," forcing the evangelist and his team to beat a hasty retreat through a back door. Team photographer Russ Busby recalled with amusement his own unwillingness to follow Graham's suggestion that he stick around and try to get some pictures. This could be real interesting. This incident, which occurred on the 4th anniversary of a communist defeat in Venezuela, seems to have been more political than religious in nature, fixing on Graham because he was a prominent American rather than because he was a Protestant, and he subsequently preached unmolested to a crowd of 4,000 at a baseball park. The reception in Cali, Colombia, was friendlier, and in the Venezuelan capital of Caracas, a city with only 5,000 Protestants, 32,000 people crowded into a bullfight arena to hear him. Response to Graham's visit to Paraguay was both intense and unambiguously Catholic in origin. The archbishop, whom one Graham aide described as a well-known flagrant homosexual who had corrupted the lives of hundreds of young men, led the opposition, directing local priests to warn their parishioners not to attend Graham's meetings. In addition, church leaders organized a protest parade through the streets of Asunción on the afternoon before the opening service of the crusade in the city. With the unmistakable implication that more than coincidence had been at work, a team member who witnessed the parade recalled a great storm that suddenly blew up while the parade was in progress. The wind blew trees down and flipped DC-3s over at the airport, he remembered. It blew the Virgin they were carrying around off her pedestal and broke her arm. The rain was incredible. It was a complete disaster. Then about an hour before the crusade, the weather changed. The stars came out and we had a lovely, cool evening. It was just a fantastic thing. Even so, crowds were modest, though not embarrassingly small, in both Asunción and Montevideo, Uruguay. Graham preached to large crowds in Chile, Argentina, and Brazil, and encountered little organized opposition. Overall, the trip was less than a smashing success. BGEA Crusade statistics, which typically list every city in which Graham has held a major public meeting, write off 9 weeks of preaching in South America under two brief entries, both consisting of tour South America. Similarly, authorized histories of Graham's ministry devote only two or three sentences to the campaign without naming a single country visited. Still, the tour gave Protestant Christianity valuable exposure in newspapers and on television. And veteran Latin American missionary Kenneth Strachan called it a watershed event in South American evangelicalism, claiming it provided an important impetus for a broad movement of aggressive evangelistic efforts that led to a well-documented surge of Protestantism in many sectors of South America. As Graham faced his other major challenge of 1962, he must have wondered if the cooperative spirit he had worked so hard to forge was being eroded. Despite his many contacts in the area, he had not held a crusade or even an outstanding rally in Chicago since his YFC days in the 1940s. An effort to wangle an invitation in 1958 had come to naught after Mayor Richard Daley, allegedly under pressure from Catholic leaders, openly opposed a Graham crusade. And the Protestant Church Federation of Greater Chicago expressed strong reservations about the high-powered bureaucratic approach Graham's team imposed on churches in a crusade city. Despite this rebuff, Graham's evangelical supporters in the Chicago area continued to aim for a full-scale crusade, often working through enthusiastic laymen who brought pressure on their more reticent pastors. 2 years later, at a breakfast meeting with nearly 700 Chicago-area ministers, many of whom had been negative about a crusade, the evangelist patiently addressed their concerns and doubts. When he finished, the chair of the meeting, an old friend of Graham's who had supported him since the YFC days, asked the men to indicate by standing if they wished to invite Billy to hold a crusade in Chicago. All 700 stood. After the meeting, Graham acknowledged that the procedure had looked to some as if it were a bit high pressure. But the chairman insisted there was no way such a procedure could be viewed as an attempt to pressure the clergyman, pointing out, apparently as proof, that Graham himself had proposed the rising vote. While the ostensibly unanimous vote of the clergyman did not quell all doubts, it clearly shifted the balance of power to those favoring a crusade. And in the summer of 1962, Graham preached for 3 weeks to a packed house at the new McCormick Place Arena. Then at the closing service in Soldier Field, he addressed 116,000 souls, his largest American audience yet. That service was notable in other respects as well. Chicago was suffering from a sweltering heat wave that caused a plaque of vapor lock to descend on the long lines of approaching cars, creating a cacophonous tangle outside the stadium. Inside, the sun's rays seemed to concentrate on the unshaded platform, and the television lights made the pulpit area even hotter, so that Graham risked a heat stroke just by preaching a sermon of normal length. At one point, sweat-soaked and sagging, his head throbbing with pain, he apparently came close to blacking out. Though he never stopped talking, one observer later recalled that he suspected an uncut film would reveal several moments of incoherence. Waving his aides away, however, Graham cut the sermon short and managed to offer the invitation. The response was substantial, and the service drew to a close with no further problems. But Graham went immediately to his hotel to sleep off his affliction and weariness. The evening, however, was not over. After years of practice, Graham had learned to time his sermon so that his television crew could wind up with a film that required only minimal editing to produce an hour-long program. Because of his problems with the heat, however, the service had ended 7 minutes early. Since the crew would depart the next day, something had to be done immediately. Aware that Graham was exhausted and asleep, some felt it would be best to have him tape a short concluding message the next morning. But Cliff Barrows had a more dramatic idea. He rousted Graham out of bed and trundled him back to Soldier Field. When viewers saw the program weeks later, the usual closing shots of inquirers streaming toward the platform were suddenly replaced by a slow, sweeping panoramic shot of a littered and empty stadium, deserted except for Billy Graham, who sat alone on the platform, obviously weary, his eyes circled in darkness. "I've come back here to Soldier Field to talk to you," he said. "I talked on Agrippa, almost being persuaded to follow Christ. Some of you during this meeting have almost been persuaded to give your life to Jesus Christ, but you haven't done it. And as this stadium is empty now, your heart is empty." For most of 7 minutes, he told them that no matter what they had done, no matter where they were, no matter how many times they had previously rejected Christ, it was not too late. And then he said, in what had become one of evangelical Christianity's most famous phrases, "I'm going to ask you right now." Within a few days, the mail and telephone response generated by that dramatic scene outstripped that for any previous appeal in Graham's ministry. Two aspects of the Chicago Crusade drew little public attention but proved to be of considerable long-term significance for the Graham organization. After the 1957 New York Crusade, during which he organized the recruitment of show business people, Lane Adams found that the hands-on experience gained while working with prospective and new converts translated easily into a more effective ministry in a local pastorate. He felt every pastor ought also to be an evangelist, but realized that most seminaries did not provide the skills he had learned while working with the Graham team. At Adams' instigation, 7 students from Columbia Presbyterian Theological Seminary, which he had attended, received internships, paid for by an affluent student at the seminary, to work with the team during a month-long crusade in Philadelphia in the fall of 1961. About the same time, a wealthy California layman, Lowell Berry, was thinking along similar lines. Berry, whose theological leanings had been somewhat liberal before his participation in Graham's highly successful 1958 San Francisco Crusade, had been convinced of both the plausibility of a more evangelical theology and the effectiveness of high-powered evangelism of the sort Graham practiced. George Wilson recalled that Berry approached BGEA representatives several times, indicating his interest in underwriting a program to enable seminary students and young ministers to obtain intensive instruction in evangelistic theory and methods during Graham Crusades. Wilson was not particularly open to the idea, responding that such a program would require a great deal of money. Berry's simple response, "Well, I have a great deal of money," cast a different light on the matter, and at the Chicago Crusade, 27 seminarians from 7 schools received seminar training and practical field experience in evangelism. The Chicago experience proved so successful that Berry continued his support. Robert Firm developed a more structured program for an El Paso Crusade later in the year, and the Billy Graham School of Evangelism was underway. A year later, 100 men, including young clergy as well as seminarians, attended a school of evangelism attached to a Graham Crusade in Los Angeles, spending their days in classes taught by members of the team and invited guests, and their evenings watching the master evangelist at work. In subsequent years, the program catered less to seminarians than to pastors, but each major crusade eventually came to include evangelistic training for several hundred ministers. Long after Berry's death, most of the expense, including travel and lodging for less affluent ministers, was picked up by the Berry Foundation. A second little-noticed development of the Chicago Crusade involved a shift in T.W. Wilson's role. After Graham persuaded him to come to work for BGEA in 1956, Wilson served as an associate evangelist, using team-developed techniques and personnel to hold crusades on his own, quite independent of Graham's schedule, or conducting satellite crusades in locations not far from cities where Graham was coming or had just been. In the latter case, Graham often preached at the last service or two to give those unable to attend the larger crusade a chance to hear him in person. For Graham's major crusades, the associate evangelist typically joined the larger team, filling in for Billy at various speaking engagements and simply enjoying the chance to visit with other members of the association. During the Chicago crusade, Graham needed a nap one afternoon and asked T.W. to handle a handful of small tasks, returning a few phone calls, conveying a message to an aide, answering a question for the public relations staff, and the like. A well-organized man, Wilson finished the entire list before Graham awoke. When Billy expressed amazement, T.W. said, "You wanted them done, didn't you? Well, I did them." About 2 o'clock the next morning, Graham went to Wilson's room and woke him. "I want you to come with me and help me," he said. The sleepy Wilson groaned. "Billy," he said, "we've been over this before, and the answer is the same. I appreciate you more than I can tell you, but I know what I'm supposed to do, and that is preach." Graham quickly trotted out the reasoning he had used so effectively so many times before. "I want to ask you a question. Are you more concerned about the number of times you can speak or the most good you can do for Almighty God?" "Man, that's beside the point," Wilson objected.
"Is it?
Think about it. First of all, I need somebody who knows me, knows my family, knows my friends, and who is an evangelist himself. Billy, I just can't do this. I know what I'm supposed to do."
"Will you pray about it?"
"I don't need to pray about it."
"Oh?
There's something in your life you don't need to pray about?"
"You know what I mean."
"No, I don't know what you mean." "Anyway," Wilson recalled with a chuckle, "he was a super salesman. I tried to go back to sleep and couldn't. I tossed and turned all night. I called my wife back in Dothan, Alabama, but she didn't help me at all with a decision. She said, 'Just promise me one thing. Make sure you're in God's will, because if you're not, you will be miserable. And if you are miserable, we will all be miserable. Just make sure you're in God's will.' Well, I didn't sleep any that night, and I couldn't sleep the next night either. Finally, I said, 'Lord, I've got to get some sleep. Please help me.' Then it just seemed like he was impressing on me that this was what I ought to do. And I've been doing it ever since." After that afternoon in 1962, T.W. Wilson spent most days of the rest of his life at the side or within easy reach of Billy Graham, serving as his gatekeeper, travel agent, valet, nurse, advisor, buffer, booster, defender, listener, jollier, minesweeper, and constant chaperone. Some team members occasionally referred to mild feelings of resentment toward T.W. because of his unique relationship with their leader. Inevitably, they perceived such feelings in others rather than in themselves, but colleagues and knowledgeable observers of the Graham organization alike almost invariably described him as an amazing man, one of the strong backbones of the entire association, a man who was able to subordinate himself without ever worrying about it a minute, and a man who knows how to take care of Billy without making everyone mad. T.W.'s chaperonage efforts did not always work out perfectly. Not long after he assumed his new post, Graham fell ill with pneumonia on his way to a meeting in the Philippines and had to be hospitalized in Honolulu. Checking himself out of the hospital against his doctor's advice, he and Wilson headed back to Montreat. The doctors had been right. By the time the two men reached Los Angeles, Graham's fever had soared, and he was miserable with a severe bronchial infection. But he insisted on returning home, where Nelson Bell could look after him. When their plane landed in Atlanta, tornadoes and pouring rain made it impossible for airplanes to leave for Asheville. So Graham insisted that T.W. rent a car and head out for home. When they got to Jefferson, Georgia, well after dark, Wilson stopped at a service station to ask for directions. Graham, who had gone to sleep in the back seat, groggily appraised the situation and staggered through the heavy rain to the restroom at the side of the building. When Wilson returned to the car, he never thought to check the back seat, but simply jumped in and drove off, leaving Graham in the restroom. The interstate highway had not yet been built, and winding through the hills in a driving rain fully occupied his attention
until he finally stopped for gas about midnight in Ottine, North Carolina, less than 20 miles from Montreat. When he turned around to wake Billy up and tell him they were almost home, he was astonished to find an empty back seat. He called Ruth to see if she had heard from her husband. "No," she said, "I thought he was with you." Wilson had recalled that